We're ready to begin, and I'd like to just, my name is Terry Shellington. I'm the moderator for this evening, and I'd like to just say a couple of introductory remarks and then introduce our speakers, each one before they speak, and also make a comment on the format. But this is a great crowd, and I look forward to a great discussion about the Muhammad cartoons and the issues around them. And we're very fortunate to have these people here who all bring such interesting expertise of their own, and we'll be able to have dialogue with them. But this event is sponsored by the Southern Alberta Council on Public Affairs, along with the library, and our partners, the SACPAS partners, are the University of Lethbridge and Shaw TV, and we're pleased that Shaw is back there filming on this. And we thank the public library for their role in making this space free to us and available for this this event at short notice, and they had to stand on their head a bit to get this worked into this evening and this time, so we're thankful. And I want to introduce our SACPA staff person, Desiree, at the back there. She's waving her hand. And there's three things, yes, in the black top. And there's three things that she can do. We're going to ask you to make a donation as you leave, probably, and it's a box with a green top on it. Not exactly Rough Rider colors, but close to it. The Southern Alberta Council on Public Affairs really appreciates people's gifts of money that support our work, and so we hope that you'll drop something in there as you leave. And secondly, if you'd like to be, the Council of Public Affairs has regular Thursday noon sessions at Erickson's as well as the odd special event, and if you'd like to be on the mailing list, the email list for what's happening, then talk to Desiree at the back, and she'll put you on that. And there's no charge to that. And we also welcome people who take out memberships and are part of our structure and support. And she can do that with you too. The format is that we'd like to ask each of these folk to speak for 10 minutes, and I'll knock on the table after 9 minutes, and then start shouting after 10. So they'll each speak for 10 minutes, and we'll take a short break. And then we'll come back and have some questions and response, and we'll have a great discussion, I'm sure. So our first person to speak is Dr. Bruce McKay, PhD in Religious Studies. Bruce has studied Islam at Toronto and Harvard, and has taught Islam at the University of Lethbridge and done some world traveling in the process of gathering his experiences. And so we have one mic here, and Bruce, we welcome you.
Thank you very much, Terry. First, let me preface my remarks by saying our time here is very, very brief, and so I can hardly do justice to the topic. Islam, like all of the major world religions, is very rich in history, in practices, in beliefs, in believers, and we can hardly claim to understand the faith or all of the faith issues around the cartoons only from comments in a forum such as this. So I can really only begin to scratch the surface. And we must also be careful, I think, not to limit our knowledge to only what we see presented in the popular media. Time and space constraints there often limit what we see in the press, and so what we receive is often little more than an oversimplified caricature. Nonetheless, let me attempt to highlight three brief points about Islam that I think will help, and I hope will help, to give the cartoons some context. First, a few brief comments about the person of Muhammad. Muhammad was born into a powerful clan and a powerful family in the tribal culture of 6th century Arabian Peninsula, around 570. By age 40, he was married, a reasonably successful businessman in the trading operations of his extended family, and with a family of his own, living in Mecca. But he sought deeper meaning in his life. And one night, while alone on a mountain near Mecca, a night Muslims call the Night of Power and Excellence, he had a religious experience where the angel Gabriel visited him and commanded him to recite some powerful but rather enigmatic words. According to Muslim tradition, Muhammad was initially dismayed by this experience, but his immediate family confirmed that, yes, this was real, and the words that Muhammad was commanded to recite, these words did come from God. Muhammad continued to have religious experiences and to receive words and to recite them to others. Muhammad himself was illiterate and could not write. In time, he developed a small following. And these words, which he and his followers saw as coming directly from God, from the God, from Allah, in rich and poetic Arabic, powerful and moving language with striking imagery, called on people to change. Words were eventually collected and compiled by others into the Quran. One of the most significant changes that people, that the words communicated to people was that they were to worship one God and one God alone, Allah, and to reject worship of all else, all other gods, all other goddesses. Allah was supreme, all-knowing, all-powerful, the one ultimate creator and judge of all. When Muhammad and his followers eventually gained control of the central religious site in Mecca, their first act was to cleanse and remove all images, all statues, all sacred objects that had been associated with worship of other divinities. Henceforth, all Muslims were to worship only Allah and to make every effort to devote themselves to worshiping Allah alone and doing only His will. It's important to note a couple of things. First, Muhammad is only a man, a human being. He is the same, then, as other human beings. He is not divine. He is not like Jesus for Christians. For Christians, of course, Jesus is divine, the Son of God. Muhammad is not. He is a man. For Muslims, the closest analog to Jesus, perhaps, is the Quran. For Muslims, the Quran is the direct word of God. It is divine. However, only God, Allah, is to be worshipped. Neither the Quran or Muhammad is to be worshipped. For Muslims, this would constitute idolatry and a serious transgression of the will of God. Secondly, and nonetheless, Muhammad was, indeed, an extraordinary man. Indeed, Muslims add the phrase, peace be upon him, after saying his name, because out of all the humans on earth, God picked this one to be his messenger. Muslims often use the metaphor of a hollow reed to describe Muhammad. Like the wind that makes a sound blowing over a hollow reed, Muhammad was the mouthpiece for the words of Allah. Therefore, Muhammad must be an exemplary man. Indeed, in Islamic tradition, the actions of Muhammad himself constitute an example, a beaten path, the sunnah, a model way for Muslims to follow as they strive to do the will of God. What does God want? In Islamic tradition and belief, the essentials are to focus on the oneness of Allah, to pray regularly, to care for those in need, to be modest and humble, to work for good, and to stand up against evil. But the main focus of Muslims is doing the will of Allah, Supreme Creator God, and rejecting the worship of all else, including Muhammad. The second point relating to the prohibition of images of Muhammad is in the context of Islamic history. As the Islamic world expanded, first throughout the Arabian Peninsula and then west across North Africa and north through the modern Middle East and Western Asia, came in contact with the Eastern Christian world, the Byzantine Empire. And during this time of expansion, which took place very roughly in the 500 years after Muhammad's death, Muslims developed and expanded their theological and legal interpretations of the Quran and the model provided by Muhammad's behavior. The traditional prohibition of images as an anti-idolatry practice was further developed in distinction to the rich use of imagery in Byzantine Christianity. In effect, the anti-imagery traditions of Islam were further developed and articulated in order to clearly differentiate Islam from Eastern Christianity. Islamic art thus developed without images of human figures. Okay? So the prohibition against images of Muhammad was further developed then in the context of the Islamic, expanding Islamic world. The third context for the prohibition of imagery is relatively recent, articulated especially by the Puritan reform movement led by Abd al-Wahhab in Arabia in the mid to late 1700s. This was a relatively small movement that was particularly influential in the development of what has become the modern state of Saudi Arabia. But the reform ideas of al-Wahhab have had important consequences. This Wahhabi movement is one of the deep roots for the extremist and militant anti-Western groups of current times. In Arabia in the 1700s, popular religious practices included the veneration and honoring of significant religious personalities. Many would offer prayers at the tombs of those local religious figures, essentially prayers of intercession asking for help from these saintly individuals. The problem Al-Wahhab saw was that these practices meant people were not focused only on worshiping God. They were not attuned to the oneness of God, but essentially they were practicing idolatry by worshiping the people buried in shrines and tombs. They were not asking for help from God, but for help from humans. Partnered with an Arabian tribal chief at the time, Ibn Saud, Al-Wahhab led a reform movement that destroyed many of the shrines and tombs in the Arabian Peninsula, including the important Shi'i holy place and pilgrimage site, the Tomb of Hussein at Karbala, an act which may still echo in the sectarian violence we are seeing in Iraq right now. In any case, the Wahhabi movement, which emphasized returning to a pure form of Islam, that is, an ancient form of Islam, the Wahhabi movement firmly articulated the rejection of anything smacking of idolatry and underlined once again the prohibition of all forms of imagery of Muhammad. So this third and most recent context, the Wahhabi reform movement, helps to give context for the reaction by some Muslims against the cartoons published last fall in Denmark. How much long? Is that it?
1 minute.
1 minute? So very generally, 3 points about the context, very brief. And I think the result is that for Muslims from this context, they would certainly be justified in seeing the cartoons as rude and insensitive, in poor taste, showing a great deal of intolerance and disrespect for a significant and fundamental feature of his or her religion. And in the current global context, where there are a small number of people who are members of militant extremist groups who are managing to drive agendas with acts of violence, in that context, it probably was not wise to publish imagery of Muhammad, something which these militants could certainly take to be inflammatory. For the vast majority of Muslims who are moderate, who abhor violence, who seek only to do the will of God, this rude and insensitive publication required only an apology. The apology was given, and for most Muslims, it was accepted. But for the militants, with strong Puritan-like interpretations of the tradition, the publication simply added fuel to a fire. And for these few, the cartoons demonstrated once again how little people know and understand Islam. And more importantly, they could see in the publication further evidence of a form of human idolatry which they explicitly reject. An image of Muhammad implies that the religion is about him, and it's not. It never has been. To suggest it is shows not only a sad lack of understanding, but it advances an idea that humans are somehow greater than God. And this, in the militants' view, is an act of great evil. It therefore provoked a violent rejection. Thanks.
He did pretty well in 10 minutes, didn't he? Our second speaker is to my far left, John von Hiking, Dr. John von Hiking, Associate Professor of Political Science at the U of L. He teaches courses in political philosophy and religion and politics. And publications include articles on religious freedom and the Charter, just war theory, deliberative democracy, and Islamic politics. John.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Can you hear me? Is that okay? Well, it's kind of interesting. You've got four scholars up here who earn their living peddling ideas and peddling words, asked to discuss the impact and meaning of images. And so there's kind of a built-in snobbery, I think, in this group, which is fine as far as I'm concerned. I mean, every year I teach Plato's Republic and we talk about how the images are on the cave and that we need to turn away from those images. But even so, when these cartoons came out and the riots ensued and the various people made their gestures of either an indignation or anger or what have you, there was a German word that came to mind which describes this very well. There's a word in German, the word is Schauspiel, which literally just means a play or a theater, but it quite often takes on a derogatory meaning when it comes to politics, that somebody who is performing a Schauspiel is literally making a spectacle of themselves. So they're in it to make themselves heard, but they're not necessarily there to listen to anyone else. And it seems that in this performance art that we call this Danish cartoon controversy, there are no Oscar awards that are going to be handed out. Everybody ends up poorly. I'll start with the question of contemporary Islam. What this says or means for contemporary Muslims is actually quite difficult, but also quite interesting to consider. On the difficult side, I think Bruce has conveyed quite accurately the impact of the Wahhabi sect and its impact on global politics and global Islamic politics. But I think at the same time, it's wise to remember that many of these riots that occurred in Arab countries were staged. In fact, the Egyptian government had a strong role to play in the dissemination of these images and the encouragement of these various demonstrations. And of course, since the Muslim Brotherhood did very well in the recent Egyptian elections, it makes a certain amount of sense for the Egyptian government, and not only the Egyptian government, but others, to deflect attention away from their own problems, away from their own legitimacy crisis, and to whip up some anti-Western anger. With regard to the Wahhabis, I would also add that Islamica magazine, which is a very interesting online magazine that's run by expats in out of the U.S., they've been reporting on some of the things that the Wahhabis have been doing towards the memory of the Prophet Muhammad. For example, the grave of the Prophet's mother was bulldozed. The birthplace of the Prophet's first wife has had latrines built upon it. And there are rumors circulating that they're going to level the house in which he was born, that they were going to turn it into a parking lot. So in a sense, when the Wahhabis are staging demonstrations against these insensitive Westerners, it might be an example of the pot calling the kettle black. Now, There's also a reason why I suggested the snobbery business. I didn't say it simply to make a joke. Because with the transmission of images and the dominance of media image making that this debate has, or quasi-debate has taken, it's hard to see how the interpreters and how the participants understand the meaning of their acts. And I want to draw attention to something that's analogous that's going on in the West and in Muslim countries away from the lights, but I think bears an important contrast or an important comparison with this. I want you to remember the name Christoph Luxemburg. Christoph Luxemburg is a pseudonym for a scholar who has written extensively and has written some very well-known books. For example, his best-known book is called Die Syro-Aramäische Lesart des Koran. I'm sure you've all have it on your bookshelf. It's an obscure book written in German, and what Luxemburg has argued is that the Koran, instead of being divinely sent by the angel Gabriel, or transmitted by Allah, was written by Syriac Christians, and that the Arabic that it is written in is actually a derivation of ancient Syriac languages. Now, that's a pretty controversial topic, and it's no wonder that the author has chosen a fake name. For example, he argues that the word Quran derives from the Syriac ancient word for lectionary. It comes from their ancient Orthodox liturgical practices. The 72 virgins that Muhammad Atta and his friends eagerly anticipated get translated as raisins or dates. Now, obviously, this can be very explosive and in some ways equivalent to the introduction of historical studies to Christian and Jewish scriptures in the 19th century. I would argue that his work has greater potential for explosiveness than even what happened in the 19th century with historical studies in Christianity. And the reason why I raise this and why it's related to the Danish cartoon episode, because it too is about the representation of the divine, in this case of words and not of images. And the representation of the divine that it is criticizing looks at the very foundation of how a religion organizes itself. And it also gets into questions of what kind of scientific methods are appropriate for the study of pious texts. Now, the West ain't any better in some ways. The various Muslims on various sides of the issue, whether the so-called moderates or the Islamists, have taken no pleasure or much pleasure in pointing out the hypocrisy of a lot of Westerners' defense of Western freedom. And so I think it was the president of Iran who snickered when David Irving, the Nazi polemicist, got jailed for 3 years in Austria for committing the sin of anti-Semitism. And of course, we can think of other infringements on human rights or on freedom of speech in the West that are done in the name of things like equality and political correctness and the like. But I think what the difficulty that Western journalists and some academics found themselves in is that they wrap themselves up in the principle of freedom of speech or freedom of expression, but it was unclear what the purpose of that defense of freedom was. John Stuart Mill, for example, gave the classic defense of free speech, not just speech, but free expression too, in On Liberty. But all the while, he argued that free speech demands a purpose, and that purpose is the promulgation of truth. And so one must ask, for what purpose are the cartoons published? What kind of truth is out there? I didn't hear too many Danish cartoonists or newspaper editors provide a defense of how they view the nature of divine being. Most journalists don't regard themselves as research assistants for medieval schoolmen. So instead, it is basically in two forms, their defense. Either, well, we're not going to let the Islamists push us around, in which case their response was a geopolitical response in the same way that the Egyptians wanted to make a geopolitical response to the Danish cartoons. The other defense that was frequently made was that, well, we need to get the truth out there. We need to find out what all the fuss is about. But what is the fuss? A bunch of angry Muslims. And that gets us to the Schauspiel Act, that this was a controversy, not so much of the inquiry of truth in the John Stuart Mill sense, but more in the terms of a Machiavellian presentation of a spectacle. So I'll leave it at that.
Thank you, John. And our third speaker is Dr. Tom Robinson, who has taught at the university for 20 years, I think. And his most recent book, co-authored with other members of the Religious Studies Department, is titled World Religions, A Guide to the Essentials, in which he wrote several chapters, including the one on Islam. Tom Robinson. Glad you're here.
Thank you. 10 minutes doesn't seem like a long time, but I've found that it's quite adequate to give wide offense, making a better option a 5-minute talk. In light of that, I'll take the 10 minutes.
Okay.
How many of you have seen the cartoons that we're talking about? Did you not have any interest in seeing it, those who didn't raise their hand? No interest in seeing them. Those of you who saw them, where did you see them? Western Standard?
Internet.
And I would guess in this lies the problem. And so we'll talk about some of these issues. How many, and you always should have a test, you know, in with academics. So I'll give you a test here. How many images of Muhammad can be found in this building? You have one. I have several. And the library would have many of their holdings with images of Muhammad. That's part of the reality. Now, I study orthodoxy and heresy and religious dissent. That's part of my gig. And I want to talk generally about some of the issues of drawing boundaries and excluding people and offending people, and ask the question, is Muslim offense of a different kind? And related to that, is religious offense of a different kind? I think we had one of our new MPs recently say, in response to the controversy, we do not countenance the ridicule of religion. Well, yes, we do. And so let's try to find out why we do, or if we should, a few questions like that. For one thing, the terms that we use often to identify beliefs that are offensive or beliefs that are considered in error are insider terms. Orthodoxy. This is orthodox. This is heretical. Even if we wanted to use more generic terms of acceptable and unacceptable, these aren't terms that drop down from the heavens already defined for us. These are terms, categories defined by a particular group and have meaning only within that context. Outside of that context, the assumptions of the group who has defined in that way don't hold. Now the question is, if a group feels offended, should the rest of society modify its behavior in light of what gives offense to that particular group? Another test, true, false, can you answer that one? If we did that, that we allowed what gives offense in one group to dictate the standards of conduct of the whole, then where do we stop with that? I'm generally offended by everything. So I will give you a list before the night is over on how you're to live your lives after this event, so that you bring no offense to me. That's the problem. If we allow one group to specify what offends them and we modify the behavior of the whole in light of that, do we allow all groups to do that? Is bacon forever gone? Do we not drive cars on Saturday? If you should use the name of Jesus in vain, which gives offense, will you be jailed or killed? Where do we draw the line to say that what offends one group should become the standards by which the whole will modify their conduct? I think that's a fairly significant issue. Have I gone past the four and can quit at five, or should I go?
You spent about five.
Okay. In the West, we have, over time, come to understand that dissent is useful. That to restrict dissent can cause serious problems in our society. We understand that dissent has a corrective force to it. It can redirect society. We kind of have come to like dissent. But there's something about dissent. If we add a particular religious dimension to it, we become, strangely, a bit more cautious. Or if we really want to turn up the heat on this, we add the word blasphemy. Why should that make a difference? If we're comfortable with dissent in large areas of life, what is it that gives religion a privileged position where dissent or critique must be more cautious, more restricted? Why give this to religious ideas, but not to other ideas that we throw out into the ring and let the debate give you a winner and a loser? We're used to arguing. We're used to putting our ideas in the heat of debate. should we privilege religious ideas? Should we have the United Nations talking about legislating blasphemy? Serious issue. Why I don't think we can go that route, there's a number of reasons, but I'm not going to be allowed to talk that long. Western society, at least in Western society is now a secular society. As a secular society, I think it can't give a privileged position and a protected position to religious speech or religious ideas. I don't think it should. We also live in a religiously diverse society. What religion will have status? What religious offense will count as offense that we won't allow? I don't think that we can go that route. Now, I'm sure you're interested in what gives me offense, since I told you I had a long list. Let me give you just briefly. One, the Western Press explanation for not publishing the cartoons. Anyone who wanted to see them could see them on the Internet. Then shut down the print press in the Western world, because most of what you find in the printed press you can find on the Internet. That's an inexcusable excuse, I think. Freedom of press, or freedom of speech, rather, does not mean freedom of offensive speech. Yes, it does. Nobody's in the street protesting Hallmark cards. It's only offensive speech that needs protection. The Western press does not have the right to reprint the cartoons, you've heard that. But Islamic clerics had the right to reprint them, add three more offensive cartoons to the package, and spread them around. Why is it okay for one group that takes offense with it, over this, to actually reprint the cartoons, but it's not okay for the Western press to reprint them? I think there's a double standard there. And what gives me particular offense is a university president seizing the student newspaper where these cartoons were printed. And what gives me even greater offense than that is that he's still president of a university in Canada. Thank you.